buried in Muharram, the holiest month of the Islamic calendar to Shiites. The banner was revealed to enthusiastic crowds in Najaf on the 11th day of Muharram, which corresponded with 19 November on the Western calendar. Shiite notables waxed eloquent on the renewed call for jihad against the British infidels, or worshippers of the cross, a reference not just to the British soldiers' Christian faith, but to the medieval wars of the Crusades that had pitted Christians against Muslims in the Eastern Mediterranean. The fortunes of war favoured the myth of the banner. In the 10 days it took for the flag to travel from Najaf to Baghdad, the Ottoman army achieved its first victory against the British. The deputy governor in Baghdad was quick to draw the connection in his speech to the townspeople who turned out to welcome the mystical flag. No sooner had this noble banner left Najaf than the enemy was brought to a halt and failed in his grand attack on Salman Pak. Shafiq Bey intoned, and the crowd roared its approval. The anxious citizens of Baghdad took comfort in the Ottoman army driving the British away from their city and dared to hope for victory, even if it took divine intervention. While the authorities raised the noble banner of Ali in Iraq, a group of Ottoman officers had resumed their jihad in the Libyan desert. In May 1915, Italy had entered the Great War in alliance with the Entente powers. The Young Turks seized the opportunity to subvert Italy's precarious position in Libya, which the Ottomans had been forced to cede in 1912. By promoting religious extremism in the frontier zone between Libya and Egypt, the Ottomans and their German allies hoped to undermine both Britain and Italy through their North African colonies. Their partner in jihad was the head of the Senussi religious fraternity, Sayyid Ahmed el-Sharif el-Senussi. Sayyid Ahmed had led Senussi forces in the Italian-Turkish War of 1911. The Senussi order was a powerful Sufi or mystical Islamic brotherhood based in Libya, with a network of lodges across North Africa and a membership spanning the Arab world. Leader of the Senussi Brotherhood since 1902, Sayyid Ahmed had continued the fight against the Italians even after the Ottomans ceded Libya to Rome's rule in 1912. His standing as head of a transnational Muslim mystical order and his reputation for fighting foreign invaders made Sayyid Ahmed a powerful partner for the Ottoman jihad effort. In January 1915, two influential Ottoman officers set out on the perilous journey from Istanbul to Libya. The head of mission was Nuri Bey, brother of the Minister of War, Enver Pasha. He was accompanied by Jafar el-Askari, a native of the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. A graduate of the Ottoman Military Academy who completed his training in Berlin, Askari was also a founding member of the Mosul branch of the secret Arabist society El-Ahed. Like many of his Arabist fellow officers, he was a staunch opponent of the British and French in their quest to conquer and carve up the Ottoman and Arab lands. He would defend Ottoman territory against European encroachment, but he would also defend Arab rights against Turkish domination. Jafar al-Askari was comfortable with his mission to assist the Senussi. Nuri and Jafar went first to Athens, where they purchased a small steamship and a quantity of arms to take with them to Libya. To elude enemy warships in the eastern Mediterranean, they made their way to Crete to await favourable conditions for a dash to the Libyan coast. They instructed their skipper to convey them to an isolated stretch of beach between the Libyan town of Tobruk and the Egyptian border town of Salem. They landed in February 1915 at a point on the Libyan coast some 20 miles from the Egyptian frontier and immediately made contact with Sayyid Ahmed. The Ottoman officers found the Senussi leader preoccupied with a difficult balancing act. On the one hand, he needed to preserve good relations with the British in Egypt to keep open the only supply route for his movement, which was hemmed in by Italian enemies to the west and the French in Chad to the south. The British openly courted Sayyid Ahmed to keep the peace on Egypt's western frontier. Yet the Ottomans were there to remind him of his duty as an influential Muslim leader to promote jihad against foreign invaders. There is no doubt that in his heart he favoured the Ottomans, Jafar al-Askari claimed. But it always proved impossible to dispel that Arab leader's general mood of gloom, suspicion and apprehension. The Senussi tribesmen made for a highly irregular army. Some were organized along tribal lines. Others were drawn from theology schools, including the 400-man elite Muhafaziya corps of religious scholars who served as Sayyid Ahmed's bodyguard. Their constant recital of the Quran in a loud, low, throaty drone through their period of guard duty presented an awesome spectacle of piety which deeply struck everyone who witnessed it, Ja'far al-Askari recalled. It was up to him, along with some 20 Arab and Turkish officers, to organize these irregulars into a standard military force before unleashing them against the British in western Egypt. In light of their battlefield performance, even the British would later acknowledge that Askari was an excellent trainer of men. After months in eastern Libya, the Ottoman commanders were impatient for the Senussi to launch an attack. Frustrated by Sayyid Ahmed's indecisiveness, Nuri Bey prompted some of the Senussi leader's subalterns to lead a raid on British positions in late November 1915. Sayyid Ahmed was furious that his officers had acted without his authority, but the Ottomans were delighted when, on 22 November, the Senussi attacks drove the British into retreat. The British abandoned their frontier posts at Salem to fall back to Masa Matruh, 120 miles to the east. The Senussi movement gained momentum as Bedouin of the Awlad Ali tribe joined in the attack on British positions. A detachment of the Egyptian Camel Corps crossed lines to join the growing Arab movement against the British. 14 native officers of the Egyptian Coast Guard and 120 men deserted to the Senussi corps with their arms, equipment, and transport camels. Following these defections, the British withdrew Egyptian artillery units of doubtful loyalty from Masa Matruh as a precaution. These developments encouraged Ottoman aspirations to provoke a broader Egyptian uprising against the British and raised morale among the Senussi fighters. The British moved quickly to contain the threat posed by the Senussi jihad. Some 1,400 British, Australian, New Zealand and Indian troops were dispatched to Masa Matruh to serve in the newly formed Western Frontier Force, reinforced by artillery, armoured cars and aircraft. Their mission was to re-establish British control over the Libyan frontier and to prevent Sayyid Ahmed from inciting a broader revolt in Egypt and the Arab world in the dangerous month of December 1915, when the British were feeling particularly vulnerable in both Gallipoli and Mesopotamia. On 11 December, units of the Western Frontier Force set out from Masa Matruh to attack Arab forces encamped 16 miles to the west. As the British infantry drew within range of their guns, the Senussi opened fire, pinning the foot soldiers down until their artillery and cavalry could relieve them. The fighting went on for 2 days, the Arabs attacking with great discipline. Scattered by accurate cannon fire, the tribesmen were finally driven back by the Australian Light Horse on 13 December. Both sides suffered relatively light losses in their first skirmish, though the head of British intelligence for the Western Frontier Force was killed. The British launched a second surprise attack on Senussi positions at dawn on Christmas Day, 1915. The sudden appearance of enemy forces provoked panic among the Arab tribesmen. By the time Ja'far al-Askari reached the front, he found his soldiers, in his words, retreating in a manner suggesting more a rout than an orderly withdrawal. Working to re-establish discipline in his lines, Askari made a grim assessment of the situation at sunrise. "I could see that our position was surrounded by the enemy on all sides." He could make out 2 infantry battalions approaching from the west, a large cavalry force on his right flank, and a large column marching down the road from Masa Matruh in his general direction, while a British warship, moored in the bay, fired with increasing accuracy on Arab positions. "It was a thoroughly terrifying sight," Askari confessed, "and I had the greatest difficulty in keeping the men in their positions." In a day of intense fighting, the British drove Arab forces into retreat from their hilltop positions. Ja'far al-Askari narrowly escaped capture, though the New Zealanders seized his tent and all of his papers. "At sunset we beat a retreat," Askari recorded, "abandoning our dead and wounded to the mercy of the enemy, having exhausted or lost all our food and ammunition." The defeat took its toll on the Arab fighters' morale, and the Ottoman officers recorded a steady trickle of desertions. The British had secured victory, but they had yet to destroy the Senussi army, which had grown to some 5,000 men. With his Arab tribesmen in possession of the coastline from Salem to the British garrison town of Masa Matruh, Sayyid Ahmed enjoyed some significant advantages. German submarines plied the Libyan and Egyptian coastlines, providing guns, ammunition, and cash to the Ottoman officers advising the Libyan campaign. Moreover, news of the British evacuation from Gallipoli and reversals in Mesopotamia had many in Egypt looking to the Senussi uprising with hope for deliverance from a hated British colonial order. British war planners were far more concerned about the reversals they had suffered in Mesopotamia than the challenges posed by a handful of Senussi zealots in Egypt's western desert. The unbeaten 6th Puna Division had been turned back at Salman Pak and driven into a retreat under fire, and the British commanders in Mesopotamia lacked the forces to protect Townsend's defeated army. Until the promised reinforcements reached Basra, the British barely had enough troops to hold the towns they had occupied in the first year of campaigning. After a relentless week of marching under fire, the weary Indian and British soldiers filed into the familiar streets of Kut el Amara on 2 December. Situated in a horseshoe bend of the Tigris, Kut was a prosperous town, the centre of the local grain trade with an international commerce in licorice root. Its mud-brick courtyard houses stood several stories tall, with intricate carved wooden decorations. Among its larger public buildings were government offices, 2 mosques, 1 with a fine minaret, and a large covered market that the British requisitioned to serve as a military hospital. A mud-brick fortress dominating the river to the northeast of the town became the cornerstone of the British line of defence, stretching across the neck of the peninsula on the left bank of the Tigris. Some of Townsend's officers questioned the wisdom of retiring to Kut. Given its location, the town was certain to be surrounded and besieged by the Ottomans. This placed not just the Indian army, but the civilian population of Kut in mortal danger. While the townspeople had surrendered to the British without a fight, their cooperation could not be relied on in a prolonged siege. Weighing the alternatives of expelling the civilians with the ensuing humanitarian crisis of making 7,000 townspeople homeless and forcing the residents to share the hardships of a siege, Townsend and his commanders decided that leaving the residents of Kut in their homes would be the lesser of two evils. Events were to prove them wrong. Townsend accepted the inevitability of a siege, believing it would be of short duration. The survivors of Salman Pak, combined with the garrison at Kut, gave Townsend a force of 11,600 combatants and 3,350 non-combatants with 60 days' rations. He was confident that his troops could withstand a few weeks of siege until the promised reinforcements reached Mesopotamia in January to relieve his position and resume the conquest of Iraq. The Turkish advance guard reached Kut on 5 December. Nurettin Pasha's forces began to take up positions around the town. By 8 December, Kut was encircled. The Ottomans, after a year of losing ground to the Anglo-Indian army in Mesopotamia, had turned the tide of battle. With the noble banner of Ali flying over the Tigris, the Ottoman army sensed victory was within reach. 10. The Siege of Kut. From the moment the Young Turks entered the Great War, the British had viewed the Ottomans as the weakest link in the Central Powers' chain of command. War planners in Whitehall had counted on a quick defeat of the Ottoman Empire for the breakthrough that had eluded Entente forces on the Western Front. Little in the Ottoman army's performance in the first 6 months of the war challenged these views. Allied shipping attacked Ottoman coastlines with impunity, the British secured control over Basra province with relative ease, and the campaigns the Ottomans chose to launch in the Caucasus and Sinai had ended in abject failure. The Dardanelles campaign proved a major turning point. The Turks held their ground under relentless Allied pressure and forced the invaders into a humiliating evacuation. Suddenly, the British were on the defensive and forced to cede territory to Ottoman initiatives. Turkish forces had invaded the British protectorate in South Yemen and posed a threat to the vital port of Aden. Libyan tribesmen, commanded by Ottoman officers, had overrun Egypt's western frontier, forcing the British to cede over 120 miles of coastline. And in Mesopotamia, Nurettin Bey had cornered an entire British division in Kut el Amara. None of these Ottoman attacks posed a significant threat to Allied war efforts in their own right. The British were confident they would ultimately prevail over Arab tribesmen in Yemen and Egypt's western desert. They viewed the siege of Kut as an unfortunate delay in the inevitable conquest of Baghdad. Of far greater concern to the British was how defeat in Gallipoli and setbacks in Yemen, Libya, and Mesopotamia played on public opinion across the Muslim world. They believed that German propagandists working across the Middle East and South Asia exploited each Ottoman victory. They feared confronting religious fanaticism at the front and Muslim uprisings in the colonies. In this sense, the British and Germans had themselves proven more responsive to the Caliph's call to jihad than had his Ottoman subjects or Muslims across the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia. To put the risk of jihad to rest, the British believed they needed to reassert their dominance over the Ottomans by regaining lost territory, relieving the troops in Kut, and resuming their conquests in Ottoman lands. The Turks had to be denied any further victories at all costs. And yet there were real limits to what the British, faced with the relentless attrition on the Western Front, could commit to the Ottoman front. In February 1916, Germany unleashed a major new offensive against French positions at Verdun. The German Chief of General Staff, General Erich von Falkenhayn, embarked on what he termed a war of attrition, not so much to take Verdun as to bleed the French army to death in defence of the position. Enduring heavy artillery bombardment that reached up to 40 shells per minute in some sectors, the French withstood the German offensive for 10 months. By the time the Germans abandoned their assault in December 1916, they had suffered nearly as many casualties, 337,000 dead and wounded, as the French, 377,000 dead and wounded. The British needed to preserve numbers on the Western Front to reinforce their French allies and deny the Germans the critical breakthrough that would win them the war. The dilemma confronting war planners in Paris and London was how to balance the deployment of forces to deny the Ottomans a major victory that might blow life into the jihad effort without drawing troops from the life-and-death struggle on the Western Front. In the relief of Kut, they simply got the balance wrong. The dangers of life under siege were immediately apparent to the defenders in Kut el Amara, who must have felt like the proverbial fish in a barrel. The Turks set about drenching the place with shells. G.L. Heward, a junior officer attached to the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, recalled. And when they got closer, they swept all the flat ground with machine gun fire. From this day, the riverbank sniping also got serious. As the British struggled to deepen their trenches against the relentless fire, the Ottomans drove their saps ever closer to the British lines. During these early weeks, the Turks made no actual assault, but they got up very close, and we had some rather anxious nights, Heward confessed, as Turkish lines reached to within 100 yards of British positions. Field Marshal Kolmar Freiherr von der Goltz, the German commander of the Ottoman 6th Army, visited the front at Kut and met with Nurettin Bey to discuss strategy. The two commanders disagreed fundamentally. Nurettin, ever the fighting general, wanted to storm Kut and defeat the British outright. Goltz, determined to preserve his forces from needless losses, argued for a tightening of the siege to starve the British into surrender. As the two were unable to resolve their differences, Nurettin waited until Goltz left to inspect the Persian front before sending his troops into battle. The Ottoman commander launched his attack on Kut on Christmas Eve. Artillery blew great holes in the mud-brick walls of the fortress as British and Indian troops struggled to repel waves of determined Turkish infantry charging their trenches. Heward's unit faced the brunt of the Turkish offensive. After dusk, they kept assaulting and bombing all through the night. They had obtained a footing in one bastion of the fort, and a temporary barricade had been built up out of hay bales, store tins, flour bags, and everything that could be got handily. The enemy were on one side and our people on the other, and bombing at this barricade went on most of the night, and all the heavier casualties of Christmas were here. The casualties were heavy on both sides, but as was so often the case in the Great War, the attackers suffered the most. As dawn broke over Kut on Christmas morning, the Turkish dead and wounded lay in piles stretching from the British trenches back to the Ottoman lines. Many of the British survivors wrote of their attempts to assist the Turkish wounded pinned down by the gunfire between enemy lines. In the end, they threw bread and water bottles to those soldiers within range and suffered the groans of the injured until, with time, death brought silence to the terrible battlefield. Weeks later, many of the Ottoman dead still lay where they had fallen on Christmas Eve. After the Battle of 24 December, Nurettin Bey made no further efforts to storm British positions. Falling in line with Galtz's strategy, he ordered a tightening of the siege instead, cutting Kut off from all supply lines and subjecting the fortified areas to sustained artillery, machine gun and sniper fire. Yet, when Galtz returned from the Persian front, he was appalled at the losses the Ottomans had sustained in the Christmas Eve assault, and set in motion Nurettin's reassignment to the Caucasus front. He was replaced in early January by the well-connected Halil Bey, a cousin of Enver Pasha, the Minister of War. The British, too, had suffered casualties in the Christmas Eve attack, and the commander in Kut, General Charles Townsend, questioned how long he could withstand such a siege. On the experience of his first weeks in Kut, the British commander calculated that daily losses in excess of 75 dead, wounded, or sick would reduce his army from its current strength of 7,800 to 6,600 effectives by 1 January, and to only 5,400 by 15 January. Still in contact with headquarters by wireless telegraph, Townsend convinced his superiors of the need for swift action to relieve his army while it was still strong enough to contribute to its deliverance. British reinforcements were already gathering in Mesopotamia. The first to arrive was General George Younghusband's 28th Brigade. Leaving Aden secure from further Ottoman attacks, Younghusband's brigade was more urgently needed to address the crisis in Mesopotamia. They disembarked in Basra on 2 December. The new commander of the relief force, Lieutenant General Sir Fenton Aylmer, arrived that same week. General John Nixon, commander of the Mesopotamian Expeditionary Force, MEF, gave Aylmer his orders on 8 December to defeat the Ottomans on the Tigris and relieve Townsend at Kut. There was no longer any consideration of conquering Baghdad. With two divisions of the Indian Army en route from France to Mesopotamia, Aylmer was confident that by February 1916 he would have the manpower to achieve his objectives. Yet the besieged Townsend did not believe he could wait until February for relief. With each passing week, he saw his strength reduced while the Ottoman army enjoyed steady reinforcement. Time was of the essence. It was imperative to strike before the Indian army in Kut was overwhelmed by superior Ottoman forces. Mindful of the political consequences of a defeat in Mesopotamia so soon after the failure in Gallipoli, the British High Command came to share Townsend's fears. With only 3 brigades at his disposal, some 12,000 men in all, Aylmer ordered General Younghusband to advance against Ottoman positions on the Tigris on 3 January 1916. Younghusband, dismayed at having to engage the Ottomans before the relief force was at full strength, later declared in his memoirs that his orders had been a very grave mistake. This premature advance was responsible for all the tragedies which followed each other during the next 4 months. The Ottoman army had established several lines of defence between Aylmer's relief column and Townsend's forces in Kut. 2 Ottoman divisions had been sent to reinforce the garrison in Baghdad. By January 1916, the 6th Army enjoyed numerical superiority over British forces on the Tigris. By British estimates, the Turks had around 27,000 soldiers in the field, whereas the combined forces of Aylmer's relief column and Townsend's besieged units did not exceed 23,000 men. If the British were confident of victory, it was only because they continued to underestimate their enemy. Aylmer's relief force first engaged the Ottomans on 7 January, near the village of Sheikh Saad, some 25 miles downstream from Kut. The Turkish trenches extended for miles on either side of the river, forcing the British to make frontal attacks over flat ground under heavy and accurate rifle, machine gun, and artillery fire. The British suffered over 4,000 casualties before taking the Turkish trenches in 4 days of intense fighting. Despite their losses, the British claimed victory and set up their base camp in Sheikh Saad. Aylmer telegraphed General Townsend in Kut, who retained telegraphic communications with the outside world throughout the siege, to announce that the relief column was advancing on both sides of the Tigris. After 35 days under siege, this news caused great rejoicings among the soldiers trapped at Kut, noted Army Chaplain Reverend Harold Spooner in his diary. 4 days later, Aylmer's forces engaged the Ottomans at a tributary of the Tigris known as Al-Wadi. Fighting in heavy rain and strong winds, the British forces succeeded in driving the Ottomans back a second time. The British lost over 1,600 men, dead and wounded, reducing Aylmer's column to just 9,000 men. Still, they pressed on to face the most formidable Ottoman positions yet at Hana, a narrow stretch of land between impassable swamps and the Tigris. On 21 January, Aylmer ordered his troops into a frontal assault across open ground on well-entrenched Ottoman positions. The attackers slipped and stumbled in the slick of mud left by days of heavy rain, facing intense Turkish gunfire without so much as a shrub for cover. For the first time in the Mesopotamia campaign, the British suffered higher casualties than they were able to inflict. After 2 days of battle, they had no choice but to give up and retreat from the Hana position of hideous memory, in General Younghusband's words. Having failed in his first bid to relieve Kut, General Aylmer was forced to wait for further reinforcements to rebuild his depleted ranks before making a second attempt. "I fear it looks as though our relieving force are not strong enough to push through and are digging themselves in and awaiting reinforcements," Reverend Spooner noted in his diary in Kut on 23 January. After hopes of imminent relief, the troops had to come to terms with several more weeks of withstanding the siege. "Bad lookout, as no doubt the Turks will be heavily reinforced by then," Spooner predicted. "But are we downhearted? No," he concluded in best British tradition. The rain clouds that had so hindered Aylmer's relief operations had a silver lining. The downpour had swelled the Tigris, flooding both the Turkish and British frontline trenches at Kut, and forcing both sides to withdraw to positions separated by as much as 2,000 yards of water. The damp conditions caused misery all around, but ruled out any Turkish assaults or surprise attacks until the water level had fallen again. Townsend's challenge was to preserve his force in fighting trim until the river had receded and the relief column arrived. Townsend's first priority was to reduce his force's consumption. On 22 January, he ordered all rations cut by half. These restrictions applied to the 6,000 townspeople of Kut as well as to his forces, for all mouths had to be fed from the same limited supplies. He then ordered British troops to conduct a house-by-house search to requisition food stores. The soldiers uncovered 900 tons of barley, 100 tons of wheat, and 19 tons of cooking butter, or ghee. Though the searches outraged the civilians of Kut, the requisitioned supplies, when combined with British stores and served in half-rations to soldiers and townspeople alike, extended the food supply from 22 to 84 days. The cut in their food rations was but the latest hardship inflicted on the residents of Kut. Their shops in the covered market had been commandeered to provide a hospital for sick and wounded soldiers. Their homes were constantly violated, as British soldiers knocked holes through their walls to provide safe passages protected from gunfire and stripped the woodwork from their houses for firewood. Civilians were exposed to the same lethal gunfire as the soldiers, rendering daily chores life-threatening. Reverend Spooner witnessed the desperate grief of the townspeople mourning a woman shot dead while fetching water from the river. The poor woman was but one of nearly 900 civilian casualties of the siege. The natives of Kut were trapped between the British, who suspected them of passing intelligence to the Ottomans, and the Turks, who considered them collaborators for harbouring the British in their town. The besieging Turks fired on any civilians who tried to flee Kut. The Ottomans had only one use for the townspeople, as mouths hastening the depletion of the British army's finite provisions. Rationing imposed differential hardships on the British and Indian soldiers in Kut. The Hindu soldiers were vegetarians, who, for reasons of both religion and taste, refused the meat ration that supplemented the increasingly reduced bread and vegetable supplies. The Muslim soldiers also refused meat, as the British exhausted the supply of beef and lamb and began to slaughter their workhorses and mules to feed the troops. Townsend initially preserved a higher flour and vegetable ration for his Indian troops, while soliciting dispensation from both Hindu and Muslim religious authorities in India to permit his soldiers to eat the meat ration. Yet the reduced rations took their toll. With fewer calories in their daily diet, Indian soldiers suffered the effects of exposure to the cold and damp, took ill and died in greater numbers than the carnivorous British soldiers. The Ottomans continued to play on the racial divisions in Townsend's army. British soldiers found thousands of the propaganda leaflets turned out by the government press in Baghdad, printed in Hindi and Urdu, when exploring the front-line Turkish trenches abandoned by flooding. According to Reverend Spooner, these leaflets were tied to stones to be thrown into the British lines to exhort native troops to kill their officers, English, mutiny, and come over to the Turks and be under the protection of Allah, telling them they would be far better treated and have more pay. A small minority of Indian soldiers accepted the Turkish invitation. Already, at the end of December, General Townsend was reporting certain unsatisfactory incidents among his Indian troops. Other soldiers were more explicit. Several times during the siege I heard of Indians, Mohammedans, who had left our trenches and deserted to the Turks, British artilleryman W.D. Gunner Lee recounted. But some who were caught in attempting to escape from our lines were shot before their regiments. The evidence suggests that only a small fraction of Indian troops actually crossed over to Ottoman lines, no more than the 72 men listed as missing by the end of the siege. Yet clearly not all Indians were willing to die for the British Empire. While British forces struggled to relieve the besieged troops in Kut, the authorities in Egypt still faced a crisis on their western frontier with Libya. In January 1916, Sir John Maxwell, British commander in Egypt, urged the War Office in London to authorize a campaign to regain territory lost to Senussi forces 2 months earlier. Reasserting British control over the Western Desert, while not yet a military necessity, he argued, was advisable on political grounds. The evacuation of imperial troops from Gallipoli, combined with Senussi gains in the Western Desert, had encouraged Egyptian activists to question British strength and resolve. With London's approval, Maxwell formed the Western Frontier Force to re-establish British control over Egypt's territory up to the Libyan border. Taking advantage of the growing number of imperial troops at his disposal since the evacuation of Gallipoli, Maxwell assembled a large and diverse force of British, Indian, Anzac, and even South African infantry. Combining such modern technology as aerial reconnaissance and armoured cars with horse and camel cavalry better suited for desert sands, the Western Frontier Force employed both traditional and modern warcraft. The Arab tribesmen fighting with Sayyid Ahmed al-Sanusi were trained and led by Ottoman officers under the command of the Minister of War Enver Pasha's brother, Nuri Bey, and the Iraqi Jafar al-Askari. The Ottoman High Command had dispatched Nuri and Jafar with clear orders to penetrate Egyptian territory and sow alarm and confusion there, tying down as many British soldiers as possible in the process. The Ottomans and their German allies saw the religious authority of Sayyid Ahmed as leader of the Senussi mystical order as a distinct asset in the jihad effort. Their successes at the end of 1915 had alarmed the British and inflamed Egyptian nationalists. In January 1916, Senussi forces were encamped at Bir Tunis, some 20 miles southwest of the British garrison in Marsa Matruh. Jafar al-Askari knew an attack was imminent when he saw a British airplane fly over his positions. He posted sentries around the Senussi encampment and instructed them to be vigilant. After torrential rainfall on the night of 22 January, one of Askari's Turkish officers woke him at dawn to warn that a long enemy column composed of infantry, cavalry, artillery, and armoured cars was advancing towards Senussi positions. The rains the Turks had cursed overnight proved a blessing. The armoured cars got bogged down in mud and bought the Arab tribesmen a bit of time to prepare. Fighting raged at Bir Tunis all day on 23 January. The Ottoman-led irregulars surprised the British with their discipline under fire. Nouri led a team of camel-mounted machine gunners to attack the British right flank, while Jafar el-Askari led an attack on the British cavalry. Sayyid Ahmed, the Senussi leader, withdrew with most of his guard to a safe position 20 miles further south. The Senussi front line grew thinner as it extended to over 5 miles in the course of the day, allowing British forces to break through the Arab army's centre and capture its abandoned encampment. The tents, with all their contents, were put to the torch, but Sayyid Ahmed's army had once again escaped with most of its forces intact. General Maxwell had ample forces at his disposal to address the Senussi threat. The Turco-Arab army, on the other hand, was losing numbers the longer the campaign continued. "Our manpower had been much diminished by the rigours we had endured," Jafar el-Askari recalled. "Fighting men would join up or disappear in proportion to the quantity of food and ammunition available. There was no permanent corps and nothing to detain these holy warriors if they wanted to leave. As ever, Arab tribesmen made fickle soldiers." After their retreat from Bir Tunis, Sayyid Ahmed and his Senussi followers parted company with Nouri and Jaffa. The Senussi fighters went south to occupy the oasis towns of the western desert, stretching from Siwa near the Libyan frontier to Farafra and Bahariya, where they were within striking distance of the Nile Valley, but beyond the reach of British forces. Jaffa and Nouri continued their efforts to harry the British along the Mediterranean coastal plain. However, with fewer than 1,200 men and only one quick-firing cannon and 3 machine guns left at their disposal, the Ottoman-led force posed an ever smaller threat to the growing British army. The British pursued the retreating Arab army to Akakir, 15 miles southeast of the coastal village of Sidi Barani. Here, on 26 February, Jafar al-Askari unwittingly made his last stand against the British. As enemy forces surrounded their positions, Nouri withdrew his regular army battalion to avoid capture. He did not consult with Jaffa before abandoning him to face the British alone with his small detachment. A courier managed to deliver a message informing the incredulous Jaffa of Nouri's withdrawal shortly before he found himself surrounded by British forces. The ensuing melee was like a scene from the Crimean War, officers charging on horseback, sabres drawn. His right arm disabled by a deep sabre wound, Jaffa found himself fighting on foot after having his beloved mare shot from beneath him. The British commander, Colonel Hugh Souter, was in turn flung at Jaffa's feet when his mount was shot and killed. "Before I was able to make another move," Jaffa wrote, "the enemy horsemen were all around me and I had collapsed from heavy loss of blood." Jafar al-Askari was taken prisoner and shown all of the honours due a high-ranking officer. The Battle of Akakir marked the end of the Turco-Senussi threat to British rule in the western desert. The Western Frontier Force advanced unopposed to reclaim the port of Salem to re-establish the frontier with Libya. The effect in Egypt was excellent, the authors of the British official history noted, and the unrest in the Alexandria district, where pro-Senussi demonstrations had broken out, was greatly diminished. With their prestige restored in the northern coastal region, the British were able to concentrate on securing the western oases. Between March 1916 and February 1917, the British succeeded in driving Sayyid Ahmed and his forces out of the oases one by one. In Cairo, Jafar al-Askari recovered from his wounds in a military facility attached to the POW camp in Mahdi. He was received by the Sultan of Egypt, Hussein Kamil, and by the British commander, Sir John Maxwell. He was most surprised to meet many friends and comrades, Arab officers of the Ottoman army taken prisoner in the Mesopotamian and Sinai campaigns. Many of those he met shared his Arabist political leanings, like his old friend and colleague, Nouri al-Said, whom the British had captured in Basra. British intelligence placed great stock in exploiting their nationalist aspirations to advance their own war aims. With the threat of a Senussi-led jihad in Egypt contained, British war planners were once again free to concentrate on the relief of General Townsend's forces in Kut el Amara. As the siege wore on, the belligerents occasionally relented in their hostility. After a particularly hard rainfall, frozen Tommies came out of their flooded trenches to warm up over a game of football, oblivious of the omnipresent threat of Turkish gunfire. Reverend Spooner claimed, "The Turkish snipers became so interested in the game that they stopped sniping and watched until the Britons finished playing." Another of Spooner's anecdotes captured a rare exchange of trench humour. A Turkish soldier, hard at work on the trenches, occasionally waved his shovel towards British lines, as if to say, "Cheero, ye British!" After watching the Turk make several waves, a British soldier took up his rifle and put a bullet through the taunting spade. "There was no work for some time," Spooner recounted, "when slowly and in a very tired way, up came the spade again with a bandage on its head." Such lapses in hostilities were an exception to the Ottomans' relentless efforts to tighten the siege of Kut. One morning in mid-February 1916, a low-flying Fokker monoplane, circling over the skyline, captivated the bored soldiers and townspeople of Kut. "Everybody was interested, as it was obviously a very fast machine," Major Alex Anderson recalled. "It circled round the south of the town, and then, when it had turned northwest again, it was seen to drop something that shone in the sun for a moment. In fact, four such things were seen to drop, and interest increased. Until this point, aircraft had only been used for aerial surveillance. This was the first time the people in Kut had witnessed an aerial bombardment. When the high-explosive bombs hit the ground, the soldiers were too stunned to react. In the first raid, an artillery piece was shattered, and sentries were buried in their trenches. A residence in the village took a direct hit, though, astonishingly, no one inside was killed. From that day forward, monoplanes, dubbed Fritz by the British, who assumed the pilots to be German, made regular air raids on Kut, dropping high-explosive bombs of up to 100 pounds in weight. One of Fritz's bombs struck the British hospital in the covered bazaar, killing 18 and wounding 30. Aerial bombardment added significantly to the tightening of the siege of Kut. After weeks of relentless gunfire, an unnatural silence fell over Kut on 18 February. The British, confused at first, feared the ceasefire presaged a fresh assault. Only on the following day did they realize that the halt in hostilities reflected the Ottomans' shock on learning of the fall of Erzurum. The Russian chief of staff in the Caucasus, General Nikolai Yudinich, had anticipated the inevitable troop redeployments that would follow the Allied withdrawal from Gallipoli. He predicted Enver would take the opportunity to rebuild the Ottoman Third Army. Each of the 11 divisions guarding the Ottoman Caucasus frontier was under strength, left to guard hundreds of miles of mountainous terrain. Yudinich decided to strike while the Ottomans were still weak and destroy the Third Army before Enver had the chance to reinforce it. General Yudinich began planning his campaign in strict secrecy. He shared limited details with his officers on a need-to-know basis and kept his soldiers in total darkness. To divert the attention of both his own soldiers and the Ottomans, he promised lavish celebrations of the Russian Christmas and New Year holidays that, set by the Eastern Orthodox calendar, fell on 7 to 14 January 1916. He also spread rumours of Russian plans to invade Persia to further confuse Ottoman intelligence. This disinformation campaign did the trick, and the Ottomans settled down for the winter, confident that the Russians would not attempt to attack before the spring, by which time they expected to be reinforced to full strength. Turkish commanders no doubt believed the Russians shared their aversion to fighting in the dead of the Caucasus winter after the experience of Sarakamish in December 1914. The Russians certainly had learned lessons from Enver's ill-planned Sarakamish campaign. As part of his war preparation, Yudinich ordered winter uniforms for his infantry. All soldiers were issued fur coats, lined trousers, felt boots, thick shirts, warm gloves, and caps. He even ordered firewood so that each soldier could be issued two short logs as protection from the cold, that had killed so many Ottoman soldiers in the barren Caucasian mountains. Crucially, Yudenich had observed how easy it was to surprise an unsuspecting enemy in the dead of winter. Enver had caught the Russians unprepared at Sarakamush, and in the ensuing panic had nearly forced a Russian surrender. Yudenich hoped, through careful preparation and total secrecy, to succeed where the Ottomans had failed. War came to Kuprikoy for the third time, as the Russians launched their invasion on 10 January 1916. The Ottomans had driven back Tsarist forces here in the opening days of the war in November 1914, and the defeated Third Army had assembled here as it fell back from the failed bid on Sarakamush in January 1915. The strategic town on the Aras River guarded the eastern entry to Erzurum. Given the concentration of Ottoman troops around Kuprikoy, Yudenich opened his campaign with a diversion to the north of the town on 10 January, followed by a second diversionary attack along the Aras on 12 January. The Ottomans fought back with determination, committing 5 of the 9 divisions around Kuprikoy to repelling the Russians. This reduced their strength in Kuprikoy itself to just 4 divisions when the Russian general unleashed his main attack on the town on 14 January. The Turks put up a determined defence, but when they faced encirclement, the Ottoman garrison withdrew from Kuprikoy on the night of 16 January. Russian troops occupied the town the following day. The defeat at Kuprikoy took a heavy toll on the Ottoman Third Army. Out of an original force of 65,000 on the Caucasus frontier, only 40,000 men completed the retreat to Erzurum. Still, they fell back on positions the Ottomans believed impregnable. 2 rings of fortifications, some 15 modern forts and batteries in all, surrounded the town of Erzurum, protecting it from the east. Moreover, by mid-January, Enver had dispatched 7 divisions from the Dardanelles to reinforce the Third Army. The first units were expected in Erzurum in early March. The Ottomans were confident of repelling the Russian Caucasus Army in the spring. The Russians were determined to seize Erzurum before the Third Army could be reinforced. Rather than rush headlong against strong Ottoman positions, Yudenich prepared carefully for the assault on Erzurum. He ordered the road from Kuprikoy widened to enable motor vehicles to transport artillery to the front. The Russian railway was extended from Sarakamush to the pre-war Turkish border at Karorgan. The Siberian Air Squadron was dispatched to provide aerial reconnaissance for the first time on the Caucasus front. While these preparations were underway, Yudenich and his officers finalized their plans for attack. Ottoman defenses had been built to protect Erzurum from attack from the direction of Kuprikoy. Rather than suffer heavy losses trying to force a frontal assault, Yudenich and his officers decided to concentrate on the mountainous terrain to the north of Erzurum, where the Ottomans, relying on the difficult topography, had fewer fortifications. Seizure of 4 northeastern fortifications would open the road to Erzurum from the north. The Russians opened their attack on 11 February with an artillery barrage, followed by night assaults on 2 of the northernmost fortresses guarding the area around Erzurum. An Armenian officer, Colonel Pirumyan, commanded the attack on the fortress of Dalangurz and took it after hours of violent hand-to-hand battles. The Russians continued their assault the following day, picking off the Ottoman perimeter forts one by one. The defenders began to abandon their positions to fall back onto the town. By 15 February, Russian aerial reconnaissance reported intense movement within Erzurum and the departure of baggage trains heading west. It was clear that after the shock of the Russian assault, the defenses around Erzurum had collapsed and the Ottomans were in full retreat. On the morning of 16 February, a Cossack cavalry regiment galloped into Erzurum. The moment captured the imagination of the Russians and their allies after 18 months of static trench warfare and catastrophic losses on both the western and eastern fronts. Here at last was a moment of glory, of men on horseback driving the enemy into headlong retreat. As Russian forces flooded into the once proud fortress town, they took 5,000 Ottoman soldiers prisoner. Over the next 2 days, the Russians pursued the retreating Ottomans, taking another 5,000 prisoners. Combined with 10,000 Ottoman casualties and perhaps 10,000 deserters, The Third Army had been reduced to just 25,000 effectives. Yudenich had achieved total success. He had destroyed the Third Army and extended Russian conquest deep into Turkish territory long before Ottoman reinforcements had the time to reach the Caucasus front. The Russian Caucasus army took advantage of Ottoman disarray to extend its conquests, taking Mush and Bitlis near Lake Van between 16 February and 3 March. The Black Sea port of Rize was captured on 8 March and Trabzon fell on 18 April. When Turkish reinforcements finally reached eastern Anatolia, they found the Ottoman position in total disarray. It was little wonder that the Ottoman soldiers in Mesopotamia were shocked into a day of silence when news reached them of the fall of Erzurum. Sobered by the greatest territorial loss the Ottomans had yet suffered in the war, they redoubled their efforts to achieve victory in Kut. Whenever the Turks dealt the British relief force a setback, they posted billboards with large inscriptions in French reading, "Kut is vanquished. Time to go home." The British, not to be outdone, responded with signs of their own. "What price Erzurum? Watch your back." Over the month of February, waves of reinforcements were shipped from France to Basra to join the MEF. They arrived piecemeal, often separated from their artillery or horses in the haste of their transport. The chaos of the docks turned Basra into a bottleneck, where units were held up for weeks while sorting their guns and horses before setting off for the front. Inadequate river transport meant that most troops had to march the 200 miles from Basra to the front line near Kut. In this way, General Aylmer, commander of the British relief force in Mesopotamia, received the two divisions he had been promised to reinforce his depleted ranks, but far too slowly and unevenly to achieve numerical superiority over Turkish forces. Aylmer faced a difficult decision. Ideally, he would wait until all of his reinforcements had arrived before engaging the Ottomans. However, with each passing week, fresh Ottoman troops were also reinforcing the Sixth Army, while Townsend and his men in Kut grew weaker and sicker due to shortages of food and medicine. Aylmer's dilemma was to pick the optimal moment to strike on the basis of incomplete information about the relative balance of powers. He chose to resume the offensive in early March 1916, as the siege entered its third month. Rather than pick up where he left off on the Tigris, Aylmer proposed a bold surprise attack overland towards the Shat al-Hai channel to the south of Kut. His target was the high ground of the Djela redoubt, the Ottomans' last major defensive point before Kut. To preserve the crucial element of surprise, Aylmer proposed to march his troops overnight to strike Djela at dawn. With the vantage point secured, he hoped to open a safe passage for Townsend's forces from the southern reaches of Kut across the Tigris to link up with the relief column. Had Aylmer's troops followed the plan, they might well have succeeded, for the Turkish lines at Djela were all but abandoned on the night of 7 March when the Tigris Corps set off for battle. But the disoriented British columns, crossing uneven and unfamiliar terrain in the dark, were delayed in their night march. At sunrise on 8 March, the attackers were still 4,000 yards from the Djela redoubt. The British commanders assumed the Ottomans would have seen their columns arriving across the flat ground in the early dawn light. Believing his forces had lost the element of surprise, Aylmer feared his men would be exposed to heavy gunfire from the Ottoman lines. The British commander didn't realize that the Turkish trenches in Djela were empty, and the Ottomans were totally unprepared to repel an attack. Aylmer knew from bitter experience how many casualties he risked in storming well-entrenched Ottoman lines over flat ground. He ordered his officers to hold their troops back and subject the Ottoman positions to an intense artillery bombardment to silence Turkish guns before ordering their men to attack. British gunners opened fire at 7 a.m. and kept up their bombardment for 3 hours. Instead of protecting his soldiers from enemy fire, the barrage alerted Ottoman commanders of an imminent attack, and they flooded Djela with troops. By the time the British were ordered into battle, the empty trenches at Djela had been filled. Ali İhsan Bey was the commander of Ottoman forces to the south of Kut. He had arrived from the Caucasus in February 1915 and spent his first month in Mesopotamia drilling his soldiers to fight in this alien new environment. He had gone to bed on 7 March with no reports of unusual enemy activity. He was first advised of the British offensive early the next morning when one of his battalion commanders informed him of the artillery barrage. As soon as he realized the gravity of the situation, Ali Ihsan conferred with the commanders of his mountain artillery and machine gun companies. He showed them the location of British forces on a map. "I told them to answer the enemy artillery and to fire on any enemy troops as they marched towards Turkish lines." He then gave orders to the commander of the Ottoman 35th Division, a unit made up of conscripts from Iraq whose discipline, order, and training he doubted. They were instructed to fight to the last man in defence of the hills to the north of Dajala. "I told them that I would execute anyone who attempted to run away, and knowing of my reputation from the Caucasus front, everyone believed me." He placed his trusted Anatolian soldiers at the very centre of the redoubt, confident that they would hold the line. Ali Ihsan Bey threw every unit under his command into Dajala, while the British artillery kept up the barrage. "The enemy did not send their infantry forward while their artillery was firing on us," the Ottoman commander noted. "We benefited from this mistake, and all of our troops managed to arrive at the redoubt before the British launched their infantry assault." He expressed his full gratitude to the British generals for giving him 3 hours to get his men into position. Abedin Ege, a Gallipoli veteran whose unit had been deployed to Mesopotamia, was in the Ottoman front line when the British infantry began to charge. He watched as thousands of English and Indian soldiers crossed the plain, wondering how he could stop so many attackers with only one battalion. "The distance between us and the enemy was only 800 meters. Both sides started firing, and the battle began. The enemy made every effort to reach us, but their forces were melting under the heat of our fire. Turkish casualties were mounting as well," Ege reported, "martyrs falling all around him. Yet they succeeded in holding their lines until reinforcements arrived in the afternoon. By evening, the British could no longer sustain the attack and withdrew. We had an absolute victory against the enemy," Ege boasted, "yet we lost half of our battalion." The assault on Dajala, known to the Turks as the Battle of Sabi's Hill, was a crucial victory for the Ottomans. British casualties were nearly 3 times higher than Ottoman losses. The magnitude of the Ottoman victory proved a great boost to Turkish morale and left the British despairing of ever relieving Townsend and his increasingly weakened army in Kut. Nowhere was this despair felt more acutely than inside Kut itself. "After hearing our heavy guns firing almost unceasingly for 3 days and 3 nights, and to hear them getting closer and closer, the forces here all ready to sally forth, the bridge ready for the sortie, etc.," Reverend Spooner confided to his diary, "it was cruel to know our relieving force had failed again." The Ottoman commander, Halil Bey, tried to capitalize on the collapse of the defenders' morale. On 10 March, Halil sent a messenger to General Townsend inviting him to surrender. "You have heroically fulfilled your military duty," Halil wrote in French. "From henceforth, there is no likelihood that you will be relieved. According to your deserters, I believe that you are without food and that diseases are prevalent among your troops. You are free to continue your resistance at Kut or to surrender to my forces, which are growing larger and larger." Townsend declined Halil's offer, but it made him think. In his report to London, the British commander in Kut asked permission to enter negotiations with the Turks if there was any doubt of his position being relieved by 17 April, when his food supplies would be nearly exhausted. The gloom spread from Mesopotamia to Whitehall. Just 3 months after the humiliating retreat from Gallipoli, the British faced catastrophic defeat in Iraq. The War Committee's concerns reached far beyond the welfare of Townsend and his soldiers to Britain's position in the Muslim world more generally. The British government feared that Ottoman victories risked provoking pan-Islamic revolts in India and the Arab world. In their bid to forestall disaster, the British cabinet was willing to consider even the most unrealistic of schemes. Lord Kitchener proposed two measures to secure the release of Townshend and his troops, each more unlikely than the other. Perhaps inspired by the wave of popular rebellions against Ottoman rule in the Middle Euphrates, in the Shiite shrine cities of Najaf, Karbala, and their environs, Kitchener suggested the dispatch of agents provocateurs to stir mass uprisings against the Ottomans to create trouble behind Turkish lines. If the movement grew big enough, Halil Bey might be forced to deploy troops away from Kut to suppress an internal revolt, weakening his lines enough to allow the relief force to break through. Kitchener's second plan was yet cruder. Convinced of the inherent corruption of Turkish officialdom, he proposed offering a massive bribe to a senior Ottoman commander to turn a blind eye to Townshend's withdrawal from Kut with all of his forces. Kitchener asked British officials in the Cairo Military Intelligence Office to give him their best man for the mission, both to raise a popular rebellion and to bribe an Ottoman commander. With none of the higher officers willing to risk their reputations on such an ill-conceived assignment, the commission fell to a low-ranking intelligence officer, Captain T. E. Lawrence. Lawrence spoke Arabic, had extensive contact with Arab officers of the Ottoman army held in British POW camps in Egypt, including Jafar al-Askari and Nuri al-Said, and had the self-confidence to believe he could succeed in such an improbable mission. Lawrence sailed from Egypt on 22 March and reached Basra on 5 April. The relief column under a new commander, General Sir G. F. Gorringe, was about to launch another effort to break through Ottoman lines that would meet with no more success than the previous attempt. Lawrence knew he had little time to launch an Arab revolt if it was to have any influence on the relief of Kut. After briefings with the British intelligence officers in Iraq, including Sir Percy Cox and Gertrude Bell, Lawrence arranged meetings with influential Arabists in Basra. His first appointment was with Suleiman Faidi. Suleiman Faidi, a noted Arabist and former member of the Ottoman Parliament from Basra, had worked closely with Basra's leading political notable, El-Sayed Torlib el-Nakib, and had accompanied Sayed Torlib on his ill-fated mission to secure Ibn Saud's support for the Ottoman war effort in October and November 1914. After accompanying Sayed Torlib to Kuwait, where he surrendered to the British and was exiled to India, Faidi returned to Basra to live under British occupation. Cut off from the Ottoman world and his former Arabist friends and colleagues, Faidi opened a small business and turned his back on politics. Before heading to Iraq, Lawrence had met with Nuri al-Said and other Ottoman prisoners in Cairo known to have Arabist political leanings. When Lawrence asked members of the secret Arabist society Al-Ahed to suggest people he should consult in Iraq, all spoke highly of Faidi. Lawrence took notes. When the two men met, Lawrence was well briefed. Lawrence arranged to meet with Faidi in the offices of British military intelligence in Basra. The Iraqi was struck by the Briton's good looks and fluent Arabic, spoken with a heavy Cairene accent. Yet everything Lawrence said made Faidi uncomfortable. The English officer knew too much about the Iraqi Arabist for Faidi's peace of mind. "Forgive me for asking," Faidi ventured, "but have we met before? If so, I cannot recall the occasion." "No, we have never met before, but I know everything about you and your activities," Lawrence replied. "How do you know me, and to what activities do you refer?" Faidi parried, nonplussed. Only when Lawrence mentioned his Arabist contacts among Ottoman POWs in Cairo did Faidi understand how the Englishman knew so much about his past. Lawrence finally came to the point. The Arabs, he argued, wanted their independence from Turkish rule. The British, at war with the Ottoman Empire, wanted to help the Arabs achieve their independence to advance their own war aims against the Ottomans. The British government was willing to provide the guns and the gold to facilitate a popular uprising against the Ottomans in Iraq. "And, given my trust in your abilities," Lawrence concluded, "I want you to organize this revolt." Faidi was aghast. "You are gravely mistaken, sir, in asking me to undertake this mighty task. I have no influence in Basra and no tribal backing. No one would follow such an individual." Faidi suggested the exiled Sayed Tolib would be much better for the job. But Lawrence, knowing the British government would never consent to releasing Tolib, whom they viewed as a dangerous nationalist, ruled out the suggestion. Moreover, Lawrence had a very short list of potential leaders for an Arab revolt in Iraq. He was determined to win Fidi over to his cause. After a long and frank exchange, Fidi remained unconvinced by Lawrence's proposal. The only concession that Lawrence could secure was Fidi's agreement to meet with three of his Arabist contacts, former Ottoman officers held prisoner by the British in Basra, to sound out their views before giving his final decision on the Britain's offer. One of the officers was Ali Jaudat, who had been captured by the British on the Euphrates in July 1915. The Iraqi Arabists spent 4 hours together, deliberating Lawrence's extraordinary proposition to mount a tribal revolt against Ottoman rule with British support. They had no reason to trust the British, whose imperial presence in Egypt and India gave little grounds for confidence in Lawrence's claims of a disinterested British policy in Iraq. They had even less reason to trust their fellow Arabs, particularly the Bedouin tribesmen. Jaudat's own experiences of Bedouin treachery in the Euphrates campaign would have made him a most unwilling partner in any project involving Arab tribesmen. By the end of their meeting, the three officers urged Fidi to reject Lawrence's offer in no uncertain terms. Fidi returned to the British intelligence office to give Lawrence his final refusal. The two parted on amicable terms. In a subsequent report, Lawrence described Suleiman Faizi as too nervous to give any prospect of leading the proposed revolt. Though Lawrence did not say so in writing, Fidi's refusal put paid to the first of Kitchener's improbable missions, to raise an Arab revolt behind Ottoman lines to draw pressure away from the siege of Kut. Lawrence set off for the front by steamboat the next day, meditating on how best to bribe an Ottoman commander. The British relief force, under the command of General George Gorringe, since Aylmer's failure at Djeila, resumed the attack on Ottoman positions on 5 April 1916. It drove the Turks back from the narrow defile at Hanna, where Aylmer's troops had been checked in January, only to be stopped by the Ottomans 8 miles upstream at Sanaiyat, with heavy losses. The British had to wait another 8 days before resuming hostilities, with diminishing confidence of success. The situation in Kut was growing desperate. The besieged soldiers were beginning to show advanced signs of malnutrition. Their daily bread rations had been cut over the weeks to 6 ounces, supplemented by 1 pound of horse meat per day, which only the British troops accepted. "Poorly and emaciated as the British soldiers are looking," Reverend Spooner noted on 9 April, "the Indian troops are looking far worse." Following the setback to the relief force at Sanaiyat, Townsend cut his rations again to 5 ounces of bread and meat. By 12 April, the starved Indian soldiers, given formal dispensation by both Hindu and Muslim religious authorities, began to eat horse meat. General Townsend advised the commanders of the relief force that his food stores would be depleted by 23 April, but that he would have enough horses to provide meat until 29 April. After that date, there would be no more food at all. To buy time for further military operations, the British found innovative ways to deliver food to Kut. Having witnessed the advent of aerial bombardment, the defenders in Kut became the first to receive food aid by airdrop. The effort was condemned to failure by the inclement weather, the weight limits that early aircraft could manage, and the poor aim of the pilots. "Aeroplanes arriving all day dropping supplies," Spooner noted on 16 April. "Seaplanes, too, but these latter are bad droppers, and as often as not their parcels go into the Tigris or into the Turkish trenches." Abedin Ege, watching from Turkish lines, noted that each airplane carried 3 sacks of provisions and that aircraft had made drops from morning to evening on 16 April. "2 sacks of flour were dropped into our trenches," he remarked, confirming Spooner's observation about bad droppers. The planes managed 14 drops that day, but the total of 2,500 pounds of food provided less than 5 ounces per head for 13,000 soldiers and 6,000 civilians. Airdrops alone would not suffice to save the besieged in Kut. The relief force mobilized for one last drive on Kut. On 17 April, the British attack on Ottoman positions in Beit Issa was driven back by an overpowering Ottoman counterattack. Abedin Ege described how the British forces collapsed before the Turkish